This is North Shore Community Radio, broadcasting at 90.7 FM WTIP Grand Marais, 90.1 FM WGPO Grand Portage, and 91.7 FM W219CU Gunflint Trail. Good evening. Welcome to First Thursday Community Conversation. With Barbara Jean Johnson, I'm Jay Anderson. We're doing an extended version of the broadcast tonight. We'll be on the air until 7:30, at which time we'll turn it over to Norman Moe and Dick Dorr for the pregame and play-by-play of the girls' Class 7A sectional basketball tournament, and we hope you'll stay tuned for that. Each month we choose a topic for discussion, invite guests into the studio, and invite you to join in the conversation. Cook County Schools ISD 166 is moving ahead with an operating referendum to go before the voters this fall. The district is also faced with declining enrollment, state aid payment offsets, possible staff reductions, and program cuts, not to mention serious consideration of implementing a four-day school week in 2011. Cook County Schools, what's the future for ISD 166? That's tonight's First Thursday Community Conversation. And we invite you to call in with your questions and comments. The number to call is 387-1070 or 1-800-473-9847. Our email address is wtip@boreal.org. What do you need to know before you could support a referendum? What questions do you have about switching to a four-day school week? The number to call is 387-1070, 1-800-473-9847, or wtip@boreal.org. Joining us in the studio to discuss what lies ahead for Cook County Schools are Superintendent Beth Schwartz, Board Chair Bill Huggins, and Jeff Kern, former Parent Teacher Association President and current member of the district's Academics Committee. We've extended an invitation to the Cook County Education Association, the Teachers Union. However, they have decided not to participate at this time. Welcome to all of you, and thanks for taking the time to be with us this evening. And last week, the school board voted to proceed with holding an operating referendum in the fall. Now, to begin with, what's an operating referendum as opposed to any other kind of referendum?
I'll take that one, Jay. Thank you. An operating referendum is different than some of the other referendums that we've passed. Bond referendums deal with buildings, and that type of referendum is spread over our entire county tax base. However, in an operating referendum, that is a voter-approved tax property increase that is spread over homestead owners and businesses. And the benefit of an operating referendum is that it helps pay for the day-to-day operations of the school, including things like curriculum, materials, janitorial supplies, a wide variety of things that we need to do to keep the school in operation, utilities, salaries of people that work there, just a wide variety of day-to-day operations that we do to educate our kids.
No new programs, no new construction, none of that.
It could be enhancing programs that exist, but it would not be construction or major renovations, anything like that.
What kind of money is the board talking about?
That's kind of up in the air at the moment. Mm-hmm. We don't want to go really high because we understand everybody's struggling right now. This is Bill, the board chair, talking. But on the other hand, we don't want to go real low and then be out of money and have to come back in a few years and ask again. So the board is going to meet next week and really kind of hash over what we really are essential, the basic essential things that we need to put into the referendum.
What are the main reasons why the district needs to float a referendum? I mean, have other districts gone for operating referenda as well?
Actually, 302 of Minnesota's 337 public school districts have a referendum in place. Cook County's referendum expired, I believe, in 2007. And so at this time, we do not have an operating referendum in place. One of the benefits that I forgot to mention about an operating referendum is if we do pass an operating referendum, and as Board Chair Bill mentioned, we are very concerned about the overall economy of the area and understanding of the taxpayer situation. let's just say the state did come through with money all of a sudden for us, the board can choose to look at that operating referendum and not follow through on all of the income. So knowing that our board's been very frugal and very good at taking care of the taxpayer money that has been spent on the district, one of the benefits of an operating referendum, let's say we go for $500 per student, if the board says, oh, you know, we only need $400 because the price of electricity dropped this year, they can choose to what we call under levy. So as the board proceeds and tries to be very frugal and ask for what we need, I know that they will take great care in taking care of the taxpayer funds.
Well, it sounds like the vast majority of Minnesota school districts, as you said, are looking at an operating referendum. How come?
The state situation is really tough. We have had what a number of superintendents refer to as flat funding for a period of 5 to 7 years, where we have not seen any increase in our state aid and what's called the base formula or basic formula. And we all know there's been increases in things like utility costs, and obviously there's been costs of even shipping materials since 9/11 have drastically increased. And without having an increase in state aid, which is our primary source of revenue, not having an operating referendum in place for us is really an issue, and that is why so many of the school districts have gone to their voters for operating referendums.
Well, didn't our income drop last year off that flat line?
Yes, it did. Actually, the state right now, our funding from the state has dropped. That's a really, really good point, Jeff. It dropped, and we filled it. The state filled it with federal stimulus dollars. And whether or not those federal stimulus dollars are going to remain is a big question at this point. And if those federal stimulus dollars, if and when they go away, because we know they're going to eventually, how is the state going to fill a very large gap in funding?
Now, if you do a referendum, it's there for a certain period of time, collecting money through taxes. But is part of this problem that you just talked about as a result of these payment shifts, or is this a long-term systemic problem?
I don't know if it's necessarily a long-term systemic problem. I think some might want to point fingers at the superintendent that was here, but I think he did a great job of keeping track of the expenses that he was faced with paying. The problem was that the state was not holding up their end of the bargain. And I guess my philosophy is we can't let our kids' education be held hostage by the state. I think the county, Cook County residents, need to kind of step up and say that we're going to make sure that our kids get a good education regardless of what the state does.
Now, Bill, when you say that the state isn't holding up its end of the bargain, what do you mean by that?
Well, the state used to pay a pretty good percentage of their total revenues for education, and that's been going down year after year. And I think Beth might have more specific percentages, but I think education used to be a very big priority in the state, and it's kind of gotten pushed to the side.
It's gotten pushed to the local communities, hasn't it? I mean, aren't they expecting us to do referendums to cover the costs? Isn't that what Pawlenty's about?
I'm not sure.
Do you want to weigh in on this, Beth?
Sure. As far as the percentages, at one point we were at 42% of the state's budget, and now we are approaching 36%, which when one looks at the size of the state budget, I don't have that number off the top of my head, but I'm sure a 5 to 6 point drop of the state's budget has to be a pretty big chunk of change. And I think Jeff brings up a point, too, that I don't know if it's the governor's philosophy, but certainly there has been a forced shift to the local school districts. And I think that in letting our referendum expire, which and they do naturally, a referendum can be held for as much as 10 years, and then you have to go to your voters again to approve it. It can be held for a shorter period of time. And again, that's an important discussion the board will be having on how long our operating referendum will be in place. But definitely the state is expecting local school districts to pick up the slack, because then the statement can be made that income taxes weren't raised, and yet at the same time it truly is a raise on taxpayers, because we are expecting more of our taxpayers.
We invite you to call in with your questions and comments this evening. The number again is 387-1070 or 1-800-473-9847, or email us at wtip@boreal.org. We're discussing the future of Cook County Schools, ISD 166. What options does the district have in light of deep budget problems and declining enrollment? Again, 387-1070, 800-473-9847, or wtip@boreal.org. Now, at last week's budget discussion, the district is looking to make up $440,000 in the 2010-11 school year through staff and program reductions. Let's talk about what options are open to you and what other districts might be in the same boat. $440,000 is a lot, and that's not all of it, as I understand.
It is a sizable amount of money, and there's two things that went into that number. First of all, we are operating under a deficit budget this year, and presently it looks like we are going to be overspending by about $250,000. That number may change as revenues come in, as we do different things, but right now we originally started it with a deficit budget of about $216,000, and that has now grown to about $250,000. So we need to make up that money. In addition, because of our declining enrollment, we will have a reduction in state aid. So now we not only have to make up that deficit, but we also have to make up the decrease in aid that we will be getting because of a large senior class that's going out. And congratulations to those seniors, by the way. You don't have much time left, so make the most of it. But we were losing a large senior class, and we're getting in what is probably going to eventually be our average type of class.
Now, could you compare those numbers a little bit? How many kids are actually going out, approximately even, and how many are coming in?
Bill's got it over there, I think.
Okay, Bill, do you have the enrollment sheet there of our seniors that are leaving? I think we're at about 60 maybe that are going out. And I believe that we have, in our ninth grade class next year, we will have 38. We're losing 62 and bringing in 38 into our high school.
Okay. Pretty significant difference.
Pretty significant, yep. Next year will be the first year that we will have two classes below 40 within recent history. Obviously I can't say forever, but certainly within the last 10 years or so.
What kind of projections are there for, I think you said this 32 class coming in is going to be about the average, and that's kind of what you're seeing down the line. You don't see any significant drop-offs from there?
38. I think we're probably going to average off, and it's hard to say because we're looking 5 years out, and it looks like in 5 years our average class size is probably going to be in the low 40s, 40, 42, somewhere in there. But then realize that after that we're talking about children that haven't been born yet. Mm-hmm. And so there it becomes really hard to predict, what is that average going to maintain? Who knows?
So to put that in perspective, that if we drop by 30 kids next year at roughly 5,000 a kid, is that about right?
Yep, that's mm-hmm. Well, that's what you would call our unreserved or undesignated fund. We actually get closer to about $7,000 to $8,000 per kid.
Wow. So at 5,000, that amounts to $150,000 we're losing.
Correct.
Yeah. So we're talking close to $200,000 just in losing those 30 right. kids out of the senior class.
This means that you've already talked about reduction in teaching staff, but what kind of programs are going to be affected due to teachers being cut? I mean, if you're going to have lower class sizes and you don't need that many teachers, but you're cutting teachers anyway because of budget reductions, I mean, what are we going to be left with, a bare bones program or what?
Actually, that's the one piece of maybe positive news in what appears to be a very grim picture. And that is, although our class sizes will be increasing, which is not the optimal situation that we want for our students, right now it looks like we will only be possibly eliminating one elective, and I'm not ready to share what that is yet because we do have some final scheduling to do.
When you talk class sizes, you're talking about number of kids in the classroom.
Correct.
Right.
Correct. But for example, what I do know, I can talk about some things that I know will not be lost. For example, our chemistry classes. We are still going to offer chemistry, but we will only be able to offer one section instead of two. We need to reduce our Spanish 1 from two sections to one section, but we will still be able to offer Spanish 1. So the electives will still be there. Students just won't have quite as many options in how they can schedule. So they might have to choose between two classes during third hour that they want to take both, you know, and then they're going to have to choose.
We've got a caller on the line. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello.
Go ahead.
As we face declining enrollment and deficits, is a possibility of a co-use on that building to help gain profits a feasible thing?
Thanks.
Okay, they're looking at me. yes, you know, that's a great question. And it is one thing that we're starting to have conversations about. The answer, I think, is yes. My initial answer was, yes, that's a super idea. And then people started asking me about, well, who are you going to be bringing into our school where our students are? You know, what if that business is a very reputable business and starts with that, but then changes to something that's not so reputable? Is that something, you know, what are you going to be exposing our children to? And that's been a big question. And I hadn't, to be honest, hadn't thought about it from that aspect. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a good question. You know, can we market the school? I think we can.
Is that model already in effect at Birch Grove?
Well, we did it here too. We had the radio station there until recently.
Yeah, we're reputable.
Damn right.
Well, but they do have businesses, I think. But maybe Birch Grove's a different thing. That's a center, and the school is only one part of it.
Yeah, because I know Birch Grove does have other businesses in that building, but I don't know if it's considered a whole school or whether they're just certain mm-hmm. portions of it that are considered the school.
Well, I would think there would be plenty of compatible activities that could take place at the school if there was space to be used at that. I mean, it doesn't have to be a business. It could be one of the social services or who knows. You've got, you know, there's always musical chairs of buildings in town being used for various things.
How do you think parents would respond to that, Jeff?
I don't think it'd matter if it was a decent use of the building. I mean, I don't think we'd have a business next to a first grade classroom. We'd probably have a different part of the building, I would guess, that would be allocated to that. You just close off a wing and let that part be used for something else.
Mm-hmm. Right. And again, I think the caller brings up a really good point, not just about renting, but looking for creative avenues for revenue for the district. You know, I think that's going to be an important part of our future.
Now, one of the other positions, some of the other positions that you're talking about cutting in this first pass, paraprofessionals. For those who don't understand what paraprofessionals are, how many are employed by the district? What would be the reduction? And in what capacities? Tell us a little bit about what paras do and how that might affect the education of kids that paras interact with.
Paraprofessionals are support people for teachers, and they are dealing with a wide variety of duties. They are a very key part of the educational system, particularly for our children who are on individual education plans, or in other words, students with higher educational needs. For example, you might have a child that has a reading disability, and a paraprofessional might accompany that child, and perhaps in that class maybe there's two or three children that have identified reading difficulties beyond what we would consider the normal reading difficulty. That paraprofessional then would accompany those children to class and perhaps help read worksheets, read a test, go out into the hallway and do some extra reading activities with them. They're a support person because, as we know, when you're teaching 20 children, 25 children, it's hard to give individual specific attention to each and every child in that room, and our teachers do an awesome job with that. However, when there's a student who needs, or perhaps two or three students that need even more than that regular individual attention, we then have some extra help for them. Other things that paraprofessionals sometimes do, they help with lunchroom duty, they help with recess duties. They in some cases in our kindergarten, we have a paraprofessional who works in there who helps because our kindergarten size is a little larger than perhaps what we would like it to be. And so that paraprofessional has made a very good connection with Dina Schleep, who does just an outstanding job. And together, they do a wonderful job educating our kindergartners.
Well, you're talking about projecting a cut of 3.5 paras. Where do you make that decision? I mean, how do you make that decision?
I look to my special education staff, and because the majority of our 19 paraprofessionals are helping with children with special needs, and in some cases, children's individual education plans change from year to year. So perhaps maybe as a child, the idea behind special education is that we help our children become more independent. So you might have a child moving from, say, elementary to middle school who maybe had a paraprofessional all to themselves, or what we would call a one-on-one paraprofessional. Maybe when they move into middle school, now that paraprofessional can be shared with that student and another student. And it will be challenging, but what we need to do now is look at our paraprofessional staff and figure out how we meet the needs of all of our children with fewer folks.
What's the flip side of that? I mean, what about, I had an individual ask me today if I would ask about kids that are in accelerated classes. I mean, are those going to be subject to cuts too?
Actually, I think we're expanding some of our college in the school courses. And the board tentatively thought that was a good idea. I know one or two board members were not thrilled with the idea, but I think the main idea for that is we can use it as a marketing tool to keep the advanced students at Cook County ISD 166 rather than perhaps going somewhere else to get their college in the school courses.
You're tuned to First Thursday Community Conversations. We're talking about the future of Cook County Schools ISD 166. We invite you to participate. Send us a question or comment, WTIP@boreal.org, or give us a call, 387-1070. We'd love to hear from you. We want to know what your concerns are. 1-800-473-9847 is the toll-free number if you're out of the area.
Now, we were just talking about... Yes, Jeff, go ahead.
Yeah, I'd like to put in a plug for the paras, too. My son, Sam, is now in sixth grade. And he's had a para throughout his elementary career, and now he's sharing one or have part-time paras in sixth grade. It's exceptionally wonderful to have that help. I think the teachers appreciate having the extra people in the classroom, whether they're assigned to Sam or somebody else or multiple people. And Beth, I'm not sure how this works. I thought that the paras that Sam was assigned were not paid directly through the district. That money came extra from special ed.
That's correct, and to a certain degree. And as the board looked at the budget reduction sheet, that was one of the questions that our astute board chair had during the meeting, and that was, what is this middle column? And the middle column, it talked about the fact that even though we save money by reducing paraprofessionals, let's just say a paraprofessional with benefits and everything is making $20,000. A certain portion of that money is money through special education revenue. So that will not be a full $20,000 savings for the district. As we look at our total, the paraprofessional reduction, the savings overall is $65,000, but then we also get a decrease in revenue of $20,000. So the final decrease savings is $44,000. So yes, we do get reimbursed for a portion of their funds, particularly in special education. Now, some of our paras who are not assigned to special education students, that money then is fully saved by the district. So not every para position is supported through special education funding.
We're going to go to a caller in a moment here, but I also want to remind folks, you can call in with a question or comment also, 387-1070, 1-800-473-9847, or send us an email, wtip@boreal.org. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Yeah, we hear so much about 166. I haven't heard a word about the financial condition of the three charter schools. Do they drain income from 166? And there's also been a proposal at the federal level that when schools are in a real bind financially, close them down and make them into a charter school. What would the ups and downs be on that? Thank you.
Thanks for that call.
Or conversely, what about rolling the charter schools back into 166 if they'd go there?
Well, so, I did have this kind of later in the show, but let's go for it.
Who wants to dive in on that?
Yeah.
Well, I know there's a certain number of board members that are very interested in starting conversations with the charter schools and seeing where they go. And I certainly am not opposed to talking, getting together and discussing what may come out of that. I don't know. I know there's been a little bit of friction, to put it nicely, between charter schools and ISD 166. But I'm hoping that in the future we can work towards some sort of mutual benefit for both our school and the charter schools.
In the survey that went out, I looked at the results of that. There were quite a few comments that had to do with, I didn't see any negative comments about working with the charter schools, and there were a bunch of comments that said they thought we should do more to work with the charter schools, and I was really encouraged by that. And we're talking about the extra space in the school. What if the charter schools would want to use some of that space?
What about the idea that when the tide goes down, all the boats unfloat? I mean, aren't these other schools in a similar, although perhaps not nearly as dire because of the size of the budget, but aren't they in a similar position, or could they not be?
You know, at this point, I'd love to give Peter James a call and say, come join us, Peter. But we actually had that discussion, and Pete and I have had lengthy discussions, and I think we have a very good working relationship. He actually is an acting or a sitting member on our communications team. And I don't feel comfortable commenting on their financial condition other than to say I know that the state situation is impacting all schools across the state. This is not just a public school problem.
Peter's the principal of the 160.
He's the director at GES.
Right. Yeah.
I would like to comment on the caller's question, you know, do the charter schools drain money from us? The charter schools themselves do not. However, whenever we have students that don't attend our district, of course that money follows the students. So right now in Cook County, there are approximately 100 students who are not attending school at ISD 166. Now, if you are one of those families that have chosen a different setting, please don't take that as an offensive comment, because I certainly understand that there's reasons for choice and want to, as Bill mentioned, we want to open up that dialogue and talk with folks and look at how can we work together.
There was another aspect of the caller's question I think we should touch on too. He mentioned at a federal level some move towards forcing districts to maybe become charters when they get into dire situations. What do you know about that?
I'm not aware of any legislation on that, although it would not surprise me if that's out there. I don't know how that would benefit the district financially.
I think the idea is that there's an advantage to becoming a charter school, and maybe we would benefit from being a charter school, not being forced to be a charter school, but there might be some potential benefits to doing that. I don't know what they are. I don't know any more about it than that, but well, I think the idea is that
just recently, like yesterday, I believe it was the Department of Education that issued these schools that are underperforming. There were 34 of them, and one of the options for those schools, besides the nuclear one of just closing it, was incorporating it into a charter school. There was no explanation of how that would be done either, Jeff. I have no idea, but it was one of those options.
I've got another question from a listener here, and it kind of dovetails into what we're talking about, and here's what this listener has to say, with dwindling resources, isn't it time to talk about consolidation and reconciliation between the charter schools and ISD 166? Shouldn't we be trying to get our kids under one roof? Wouldn't it be better for the kids in the long run? And why isn't this being talked about?
Boy, I'd like to speak to that. I have a child in both schools. Sam is my oldest son is at 166, and he's got a great education there, and I'm very supportive, and I do a lot of volunteering there. My other son, Andy, is over at Dart GES, and he's getting a great education there. And I think that having that choice has been wonderful for us. We made it. It's a difficult choice, but we made it after looking at a lot of different options, and we had a lot of reasons for it. Not that one school's good and one school's bad. Obviously, we chose them both. But having that choice is I think, a huge benefit. And I've seen in my time there, the competition, I think, is good. I really do. I think cooperation and working together is a good thing, too. But I like having the choice myself.
Anybody else want to jump in?
Well, I'll just reiterate that there are a number of board members that are very open to starting to work on perhaps things with the charter school that are going to mutually benefit. And I think the key there is to talk about mutual benefit. We don't want to be just benefiting the charter school to the detriment of our school or vice versa. We need to kind of be working and cooperating so that both parties are benefiting.
Okay, thanks.
The charter school is a very different model of education, and I think that it suits some kids. And I think there's kids I've known there's kids that have gone to the charter school and come back to the big school with good results. It's not a question of one's better than the other. It's a question of they're very different, and they serve different needs.
You're tuned to First Thursday Community Conversations. We're talking about the future of Cook County Schools, ISD 166. If you'd like to join our conversation with a question or comment, give us a call, 387-1070, or toll-free 1-800-473-9847. You can also send us an email at wtip@boreal.org. We'd love to hear from you.
We were talking a few minutes ago about the possibility of other uses for the school building, and that kind of dovetails into a question that we received earlier in the week from a listener. And the point is that Cook County Schools is a big physical plant, and one of the things on the cut list is a janitorial position. Is that going to be a problem when you have parking lots to plow and that whole top to bottom summer cleaning thing? I've actually been in the school when that's happened, and that's, I mean, is that a viable cut reduction?
Boy, you know what I see? I see the teachers having the kids sweep up around their desks. I see them with much dirtier classrooms because there's not as much staff. The sidewalks don't get cleaned as well. The doors don't always work as well. We're making a lot of these cuts, and people think, what am I trying to say? It's easy to try and gloss over how much of a strain it is on the system, and I think it's huge. I think that these cuts we're making are a big deal, and they've been a big deal for a long time. And I'm furious at the state for not picking up their end of the deal here and paying for more of what we need. Education's gotten the short shrift, and I think that it shouldn't be. And unfortunately, basing it on property taxes is, in my opinion, the wrong way to go, but it's the only choice we have right now.
Let me switch topic a little bit here. The Ely School District has some budget trouble, and it's being criticized for what critics are calling excessive teacher salaries. So where does Cook County Schools stand in comparison with other districts our size on salaries? I mean, are we in the ballpark on that? Is this just an aberration up at Ely, or where do we stand?
And can we start that discussion with where teacher salaries are relative to other equally other occupations that are equally require equal qualifications? How's that?
Yeah, we can. As we all know, Cook County is a beautiful place to live, and we pay for that choice to live here with a higher standard of living and higher cost of living that goes along with that. Many of our young teachers are renting homes versus buying homes, as many other folks in other professions have moved in realize. We lost a doctor recently who was unable to sell her home down in the metro area. Very good doctor, by the way. And all of our physicians are very good, but you always hate to lose a pediatrician, I think, once you have one established. And so it's a problem. And when I say that our teachers, if we look at comparably sized districts, are compensated well, but when you were to factor in the cost of living, I'm not so sure where we sit. There isn't, as far as I know, the information out there that shows you what the salaries are in comparison to cost of living. And I think that's probably a more important question when you get up into this area. Do I think that teacher salaries have put us into the situation that we're currently in? No, I don't. They were it was a hard negotiations. They were reasonable. We did not add any increase to our salary schedule. And that alone, I think, says a lot. If you look across the state, I think the governor commented on schools that were giving increases to the salary schedule, and our teachers chose not to do that. Our staff as a whole was very cooperative. The Teamsters and our other folks took a hard freeze. I think our employers are doing everything in their power to help support the district during, you know, what is really an unprecedented time in education funding. And I think that that's huge. In comparison to other professions, I would say that we, teachers across the board, are undercompensated. I mean, they're paying for school loans that other people are paying for with four-year degrees with much less salary than what other four-year occupations earn. You know, with that said, we also know we're in a service profession, and folks work hard, and they didn't go into teaching. For that reason, they went in to serve kids.
Isn't it also true that we have a higher, better educated staff than many schools?
Yes, that's true as well. Our staff is older than most, and we do have a number of teachers with master's degrees. One thing that perhaps there's others out there listening from other districts where I've taught, I apologize for the following comment, but it's simply true. I truly believe that out of all the staffs that I've worked with, this is the most talented staff that I've worked with their willingness and ability to teach our kids. They are really a phenomenal group of people.
A follow-up question on that, from a listener asked earlier about early retirement incentives. Are they being discussed?
Yes, we discussed them after the last board meeting. And unfortunately, we were not able to offer them one. We just felt that we could not afford to really give them enough of an incentive that it would be worth their while. We talked long and hard about it, but we just couldn't get it squeezed out of the budget.
Well, again, this is First Thursday Community Conversation on WTIP with Barbara Jean Johnson. I'm Jay Anderson in Cook County Schools. What's the future for ISD 166 is our topic. Our guests are Beth Schwartz, Bill Huggins, and Jeff Kern. And if you have questions or comments, give us a call. Number is 387-1070, toll-free 800-473-9847, or use our email address. It's WTIP@boreal.org. Now, for at least 2 years, the district has been considering a four-day school week, and it's under serious consideration for the 2011 year. What are the financial advantages, and what are the academic advantages, and what are the disadvantages of a four-day?
Well, the four-day school week has been around for a very long time, but it is new to Minnesota. If you look across the nation, there are a couple of reports that are out there that look at what the benefits of the four-day week are. Originally, it was started solely for cost savings. I mean, that's why districts went to it out in states where transportation was a huge cost, you know, Arizona, Colorado, Wyoming. And it started strictly as that. When I came on board in July, 4-day week was mentioned. And to be honest, I was very skeptical about it. But I think good educators always keep an open mind and listen to all sides. And because this district was seriously looking at it, I started digging into the research and looking at things, and then pulled a group of educators together. We specifically chose to meet with a few key teachers, and we went through the research documents that I provided them. And what we did find was that even though initially it was started for cost savings, there were some very significant academic reasons to at least look at the 4-day week under a microscope. Those advantages included lower dropout rates, better attendance, fewer discipline problems, better morale both on students and teachers. And one of the surprising things that came out of some of these studies is that the communities, they themselves also, after being involved with the 4-day week, were very positive towards it and didn't want to see it dropped.
Why those improvements? Was there anything in the studies to indicate why? Fewer dropout rates, fewer disciplinary problems, those kinds of things?
A lot of it is attributed to the morale issue. Students and teachers were getting along better. Just having that extra break, that extra day break, stress reduction, particularly students involved in a lot of activities talk a lot about, you know, they actually feel like they get a weekend, you know, or at least one day on a weekend. Because let's face it, a lot of these kids travel on Saturdays. You know, Sundays maybe are a church day. You spend that time, and then all of a sudden you make a run to Duluth, and your weekend's gone here. And students come into school Monday exhausted, tired. And what the districts in Minnesota, the four districts that have the 4-day week in place, they are reporting basically what the studies have been stating. The one piece that's out there is, you know, how does this affect your test scores? And that doesn't seem to have a profound effect in either direction. But the question is the longitudinal studies, or in other words, studies over a long period of time have really not been conducted thoroughly on this.
Mm-hmm. I understand. I was in the office this morning when Jan Horak called, and he said that he used to be a teacher here, and they had a 4-day week. And his comment was, at least what I overheard, I didn't talk to him, that they did it with alternating days. So one week it would be a Tuesday through Friday, and the next week it would be a Monday through Thursday. So you'd have a 4-day week end and then a 2-day weekend alternately.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. We do have a caller on the air. Hello, you're on the air. Hello, are you there? Caller, did we lose you? They're still on the line, but maybe they stepped away. All right.
Well, we'll just continue with this discussion. I have a lot of questions, and we have received a number of them. Let's talk a little bit about the nitty-gritty of a 4-day week. What would it look like? Jeff, you just mentioned alternate days. There are, as I understand it, there are four schools currently in Minnesota using the 4-day program. The Lake Superior School District, just our neighbors, they have started that discussion. And if I'm not mistaken, there's one I think it's in the New Brighton area of the North Twin Cities that is either going there or talking about it. So there aren't too many examples in Minnesota. But what would it look like? Which day is off? And how does it affect the schedule for students?
As we look at working with folks, and I want to assure both the staff, but particularly the community members out there, this is not something that's going to be mandated and kind of forced down, you know, forced on everyone without some serious discussions. So I want to assure the public out there that we are going to be having some public discussions in April and May. The other thing I want to make very, very clear is that we are not, and I know, Jay, you mentioned 2011, but I want to make sure it's clear that we are not looking at the 4-day week for this coming fall. We need to have some serious discussions on it, and we need to have some serious planning time if we go that route. So the answer as to what it would look like is currently not decided. In other words, we know that it will probably be either a Friday or a Monday off. the things that you look at and the districts in the state, and I couldn't tell you for sure which one has Friday, which one has Monday, but what I've been encouraged to do by other superintendents is to look at that attendance piece. When are students gone? When do teachers need substitutes? Some school districts find it's on a Monday. Some school districts find it's on a Friday. And you choose the day which will save the district the most money, because you save money when you don't have to get substitute teachers. And of course, we want our attendance rate to benefit as much as possible too. So you try to pick the days when students miss the most. And I'm going to guess that it will probably